the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Today we're here with Andy Jackson, our policy analyst at Civitas, and he's going to help us unravel the SHIELD Act. There's a lot of controversy around the legislation that just passed the U.S. House. There's similar proposals perhaps in North Carolina, and we'll talk to him about that. And we'll also look at just the recent veto by Governor Cooper to stop the expungement of whether it be legal immigrants or just anybody who's on the electoral rolls that aren't supposed to be there. So, Andy, how's it going today?
It's great. It's nice to be back. It's been a few months since I've been here.
Well, we are glad to have you on, Andy. So thank you. And I think you, as the communications director here, I think I have received more requests for interviews with you than anyone else in the office as of late, because as the elections policy analyst going into 2020, there you are going to be in high demand and already are. So first off, how do you feel about this rising celebrity status you are acquiring?
I am almost starting to get recognized down at the General Assembly. There's been one or two legislators that have, they don't know my name yet, but they know my face. So that's a good start. And I do know, and I've been exchanging with folks online, by phone, and other ways. So things are definitely picking up, and it's not going to slow down anytime soon. We've got the current redistricting going on. Obviously, we're taking that straight into election season with the primaries and the general. And then it's not done even after that, because we get another round of redistricting after that. So we really have a solid 18, 24 months of pretty much nonstop election news going on in here in North Carolina. So it's a really exciting time to be in this position. And I'm looking forward to the whole time. It's been great so far.
Andy, let's just jump into it right away. This SHIELD Act, I think it was on October 23rd, passed the U.S. House. It basically passed along party line votes. I think there was one Democrat that voted against it. And then, of course, Justin Amash, who's now independent, voted against it. But, you know, what's wrong? I mean, when you read the face of the legislation and kind of just glance at it, what's wrong with prohibiting foreigners from being involved in our elections? I mean, what's the trap there?
Well, there's a couple of broad problems with it. I mean, first of all, it's not just regulation of foreigners involved. This is about interactions with Americans and foreigners. So this has been similar to other debates that we've had regarding the Patriot Act and other issues, that when you have a bill that's ostensibly regulating what's going on with foreigners trying to interfere, but you're actually imposing penalties on Americans. One of the examples is there are aspects about people trying to get information about, like, what's happening with, say, a WikiLeaks leak or something like that, or information that comes out. That would be prohibited information for an American kid, even if it is true. And groups like the ACLU have actually come out against this bill in its current form, because it is preventing people, American citizens, from receiving information that they would otherwise be able to get, and which could have an impact on their lives. Now, I think most people are on board on trying to prevent foreign interference on elections, but groups as far afoot as the Cato Institute and the ACLU both have concerns about this, just because it's going to have these kinds of impositions on what Americans can receive. And free speech is not just about the right to speak. It's also about the right to listen and to hear. And that's a problematic. That's one of several problematic aspects of this bill.
So I think that's really a good point to end that question on, your response to that question, because free speech really is, our founders intended that to be extremely broad. It's not something that, of course, they didn't foresee the digital age in the way that we exist in it now. But nonetheless, it's a first principle for this idea of free speech. And so what are some of the concerns that we, and obviously, like you named Cato Institute, who is a libertarian outfit, as well as the ACLU, which is very far left for the most part. They share this common concern about the infringement of free speech. So what do you think is really behind some of this this push with politicians? Do you really think their motives are altruistic on this front? Like they genuinely just want to protect Americans and are willing to sort of sweep free speech under the rug in order to nanny us in this way? Or is there something else going on?
In my general experience working with politicians, I honestly have a pretty high opinion of politicians in general. I know that puts me in a very small minority in the world, but most of them, at least ostensibly, most of the time have in their own minds, you know, what is right and true. The problem is that, especially since we're dealing with incumbents here, this supposed altruism dovetails quite nicely with an effect that this bill is going to have, which is going to be to make it much more difficult for political amateurs, for challengers to engage fully in online communications. Now, incumbents, they already have the experience, they already have teams of lawyers, they're going to be able to get through these kinds of regulations, restrictions that are going to be posed on internet speech. But somebody that's just starting on the campaign, this is going to be prohibitive for them in a lot of ways. So this, in essence, becomes, as it's now written, going to be kind of an incumbency protection act because it's going to make those restrictions go down disproportionately on folks that, you know, basically are new to the system.
Andy, I have a question about federal encroachment. There seems to be some concern with this legislation, not just in terms of speech, but federal encroachment upon local state elections. The Attorney General may have powers, broad powers to sort of, give sort of commands about speech to some extent, but also maybe referee some aspects of elections. I mean, what is your understanding of that? Because, I mean, obviously we're all concerned about federal encroachment in elections.
Right. Well, this act wouldn't just kind of restrict what we had normally considered direct political advertising. The phrase that they're using to regulate this kind of online political speech is any message relating to any political matter of national importance.
Which is everything.
Yeah, that is really, really broad. I mean, you could, if, for example, if you were concerned about DACA and DREAM Act stuff and you wanted to communicate about that, well, that's obviously an immigration issue. That's national concern. If you're dealing even with ostensibly local issues, like anything to do with like business dealings in your community, in your county, well, obviously Commerce Clause, you know, that's a national concern as well. So this really provides a potential for overreach. And the problem is with online communications, with other forms of communication, when you do TV, do radio, you have a geographic limit. If somebody's doing an online ad, there's no real limit or they're boosting a Facebook post. This could appear anywhere at any time. And so if it somehow has any intersection with a political campaign halfway across the country, it could still be regulated. So somebody in North Carolina could be posting on an issue or saying or making some reference to Nancy Pelosi. Well, she's running for re-election next year in San Francisco. Well, that's going to potentially bring down a penalty on any person making a reference in a promoted Facebook post here in North Carolina. It's really, really broad, and that's going to be an issue that's hopefully going to come up if this gets debated in the Senate.
I have a question, too, just in terms of, like, you know, a lot of us are on social media. We're on Facebook. You know, maybe some of us have parents or an uncle that posts these stories that are clearly fake news. You know, Hillary caught, smuggling children to Bill Clinton for sexual dalliances or something. You see some of these crazy stories on Facebook sometimes. I'll say that didn't happen, but we don't know. And so is this type of legislation going to stop some of this fake news being on Facebook or wherever it gets posted? I mean, you know, some of these absurd stories that people are sharing, we may even get them texted to us or shared into our inbox. It's all happened to all of us. I mean, would this legislation stop that?
Oh, it wouldn't stop anybody's crazy uncle from posting anything, for good or bad, because this deals with just things that are promoted. So you'd have to spend some money before it kicks in at some point. But so you're not going to have that kind of content limited. But if somebody is trying to make an impact in their community and they want to promote this in some way, then yes, that could be an issue. Now, as the current law is under the Constitution, I mean, falsehood is really a civil matter. You sue somebody for libel and damages and that sort of thing. It's not a criminal matter. And this is an issue that a lot of folks has brought up as well, that what you're doing is you're criminalizing speech in a way that it hadn't been done before. And so that's going to be, once again, another reason why this thing ought to get shut down, if it's even considered at all in the Senate.
Yeah, just a comment on that front. When you talk about criminalizing speech versus it being a civil matter, I think that this is something that we're seeing more and more, even not just on college campuses, but elsewhere, where there's this notion of speech as violence. And so I think that this is yet just one way, which obviously a violent act would be a criminal act, right? It's not just a civil one. And so I think that this is just yet another example, although I'm sure it's not, it's in no way coordinated on that front with some of the issues that we're seeing in college campuses. But can you also speak to the way that I know Ray talked about the crazy uncle posting things, but how would this, and you also talked about the incumbents creating an advantage there, but what are some ways in which this would actually hurt our ability to really, I guess, debate in the public square in any sort of legislation like this? Is there something directly that this bill would impact on that front?
Well, the direct front there is really how it deals with people promoting their message on online platforms. So as I mentioned before, if you're just doing a normal post on something, it's not going to really have an impact there. But the real impact is going to be on somebody who, or some small group of people that have a real concern about a particular issue or interest, or a politician that they don't like, or say a local mayor who is causing some concern, or people that are angry because the town has taken over the right of way and they're going to expand the road into people's front yard, so they step right off their porch onto the street, and they want to let people know about that, and they want to try to do something to promote that ad so that more people can see it. This triggers in at the $500 mark, which in modern media, especially if you get together with a couple of friends, you're going to end up, you know, tripping that and having that applied pretty quickly. Then you're going to have essentially costs that are imposed by the providers. There's going to be this kind of online depository of ads. You've got to include, like, who's your target audience. You have to have some level of analysis. Now, for kind of the big boys in there, this is not going to be a big deal. But, you know, a lot of folks that just want to get the word out, they're not going to be able to really navigate this. And so in the end, you're really, you know, by imposing this kind of barrier, you're really imposing a limit on how people can express themselves, and by extension, what people can hear in that community.
I'm a big free speech guy. I know, I think everybody here is, obviously. What's kind of driving some of this stuff? I mean, why can't we just have broad free speech protections? Is there anything you see? Let's say this gets passed. Obviously, we know I don't think the Senate is going to take this up, at least on the federal level, and I don't think Trump's going to sign anything like this. But you know, if something like this does pass at the federal level, what does it look like in the courts? I mean, you know, we have these broad speech protections, and it seems like the courts, at least generally, have been very aggressive in terms of striking down any limitations on speech. So, I mean, does this fall under that?
Potentially, but the courts have also upheld restrictions that the Federal the Elections Commission has imposed on speech. So there is precedent for them to allow certain restrictions on, say, spending levels, some content. But this really takes it beyond that, because folks are comparing online speech to TV or radio, but they're essentially different mediums. With online speech, people are simultaneously consumers and producers of information. There's this give and take. There's this engagement going on. Whereas if you're sitting in your car, maybe you could change the channel or turn the radio, but there's none of this give and take that goes on. In a certain way, online communications are kind of a throwback to earlier times where people you know, we're talking about issues a little more directly. So I think that this is really an unwelcome imposition into an area that really is not the same thing. Now, I'm a fan of having freer speech in all mediums, TV, radio, and all. But this one in particular is problematic. And part of the issue that they had, I'm going to segue if you don't mind real quick, is this is another strike against trying to have some anonymity in speech in a way that you can actually get the word out to people. And this decoupling of the message and the messenger is really important. It's been important since the founding of the Republic. The Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, those were written under pseudonyms. So the founders recognized that this is something that's important, and it's probably not in anybody's best interest to have the government in the interest of ferreting out everybody who has some opinion on some politician or some act that in this very broadly defined bill could be just about any kind of communication.
Okay. So if we're really concerned about foreign interference in elections, what are we to do? What is an actual remedy that we can point to that really is in promotion of national security and making sure our elections are fair and secure?
Right. Well, first of all, this bill isn't going to do any of that. If you are a group of Russian hackers, you're not going to worry about a depository. You'll set up umpteen dozen fake groups, spend $499 so you don't trigger the law here, and then just move on. They have the capacity to do that. I mean, preventing foreign interference in American elections is not really, and this is going to sound strange, not really an elections management issue. This is actually an espionage issue, and this is best handled by anti-espionage groups in the United States government. And they've done that in the 2018 election. Groups and intelligence organizations in the United States had been tracking hackers from Eastern Europe, particularly Russia and some other places, and had been able to shut those down and counter those. And so it's the law here is not really a good tool to do that. It's really an intelligence issue.
Let's just transfer over to Senate Bill 250. Speaking of foreign just influence in elections, so we just had a recent veto yesterday, last evening, which was October 6th, I believe. I mean, November 6th, I believe. So just talk to us about this bill. Give us some context because, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. Cooper says that it will remove people from the voting rolls. And, of course, Republicans that supported the bill are saying, no, it just takes voters off the rolls that shouldn't be there, that are not legal citizens of the nation and the state. So what's kind of your thoughts on this? I know you've written about this and studied it some, but what are your thoughts? I mean, is this just a partisan bill that Republicans put up there to try to make Cooper look bad before the election?
Well, it may have been a twofer, but this bill, I mean, we had, I believe it was either 17 or 19 people that have been convicted of illegally voting in North Carolina in 2016. So we know that this is an issue that exists. We may not be 100% sure about the extent of the problem, but we know it is a real problem that should be addressed. And this doesn't really break any super new ground. All it does is take people that have been excused from jury service for a couple of reasons, but the one we're talking about here is not being an American citizen. All it does is share the information from the judiciary to the North Carolina State Board of Elections, where they begin the normal process of maintenance of the list, removing people that are ineligible to vote in North Carolina. This happens all the time. This is not the end of the process. It's actually just the start. They seek to contact the voter. If the person that is registered to vote says, hey, I really am a citizen, they have a chance to appeal. There's verification of this information by the State Board of Elections. So it's not just that you're going to willy-nilly start throwing people off the rolls. It's just that just doesn't exist. So Cooper is really being disingenuous there when he talks about that. And so it is a little strange that he and his Democratic colleagues have decided this is going to be the hill that they want to die on. But there it is. But it's just not going to do what they claim it's going to do.
okay, it's not going to do what they claim it's going to do. So what is his reasoning for opposing this?
The claim is that they believe that, or they say they believe, that this is going to somehow cause massive purges of voters. They claim also that making the names of people that are removed because they are foreign nationals public would subject that person to harassment. The reason we have that is to prevent further, prevent this individual from once again registering to vote again at another place. I mean, so this is an act that is illegal. And so it is important that this be maintained in a way that people that want to verify, citizens that want to verify that people that are voting in their precinct are actually legally able to vote in their precinct, that they can, you know, be part of that. That's part of our duties as citizens, is to essentially be election watchers. And so having that information public is important.
Well noted then. That's something, though, that I know in the 2016 election, obviously I don't think we're ever going to approach voting quite the same, or the 2018 election here in North Carolina with our 9th congressional district and all the drama going that went on with that, and the special election that subsequently had to be called. So going into 2020, I'm curious as to what your predictions are. Do you see us having even more battles after an election has occurred, such as the case in, I think it was Arizona, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, where there's these accusations of stolen elections? And is there anything we can do to mitigate that going forward?
One thing that I think maybe insulates North Carolina from that is that we don't have any elected officials that are conducting list maintenance here. One of the first things I wrote when I came on at Civitas was mentioning that they had stricken about 500,000 people from the voter rolls, mainly because they had been inactive for several election cycles. They had been contacted. There was the formal procedure to maintain the list. And maintaining a list is really important, because the more people that are on the list that are not current registered eligible voters, the more chance you get for election shenanigans by various nefarious actors. So it is important that you have maintained lists. It's also a federal requirement that states maintain the list. So I don't think we will necessarily have that. I think anytime you have people losing, they will look for a reason they lost. You know, it couldn't have been the voters. It isn't that the voters, you know, weren't listening to your message. There had to have been some, you know, somebody lied, somebody cheated, somebody stole. And if you've got enough people who, and we do have this in North Carolina, who make their careers out of enabling that kind of thought, that the reason why we don't have a Democratic majority in the legislature is because the system is unfair, then people, you know, candidates will believe that. So it's possible that we'll have it, and we've already had it. I don't think it's especially likely, just at least on the as far as the voter list maintenance goes, but I wouldn't put it past us. I mean, North Carolina is one of the most exciting states politically in the country. Maybe everybody says that, but I think it's particularly true here. And so I think it's going to be fun no matter what happens.
Before we wrap up here, Andy, I want to just ask you a question that I saw. I'm sure you saw it too on Twitter last night and just various social media outlets, but I saw a lot of Democrats in Virginia bragging that they were able to overtake the House. I think it's the House of Delegates in Virginia. I can't remember exactly. So they have a bicameral legislator. But they were bragging that they had won with the maps drawn by Republicans, and saying that, you know, that they didn't need different maps to win, that they were able to win under the maps that the Republicans had drawn, partisan maps that they had drawn there. I mean, what's so different than North Carolina? If you just see that, you know, if you're just kind of looking at the news and seeing that, the Democrats saying, hey, we could do this, we did it here. Obviously, when it's their turn, they're going to draw maps more to their advantage. But what's the difference here in North Carolina? Why can't Democrats say that we can win with the maps that are currently in place?
Well, without getting too far into weeds, there's a couple of differences. One, there was actually some of the maps in Virginia were changed. They had a lawsuit a while ago. Certainly not all. I forget the exact number, but it was like less than a quarter, I believe. And so that may have affected one or two races. This was, Virginia has been changing, mainly because of Washington, D.C. It's one of the more perverse things I've ever seen was that during the financial crisis, while the rest of the country was suffering, housing prices in Washington, D.C. area were still going up. And so folks are moving in, disproportionate liberals affecting the state. If you look now, the Democrats did make gains all across the state, but they've grown such a foothold in that northern part of Virginia. It's kind of a different beast than in North Carolina. And we also have to remember that when the Republicans won in 2010, they won with maps drawn by Democrats for the benefit of Democrats. So it is certainly not impossible to kind of bust through districts, gerrymandered districts drawn for partisan advantage. And they could do it there, but you actually have to get the votes. And there they haven't done it. I mean, the claim is, well, we get really close. We get around half, maybe we get 51%. But people in North Carolina, the way we live, a lot of Democrats tend to be concentrated in cities, whereas Republicans a little more spread out. So at least part of this is geography. And WRAL did an analysis of the maps that came out after that last round of state legislative redistricting and found out, yes, actually, these are essentially fair maps. They don't particularly disadvantage any party different than what you would expect from like kind of a randomly drawn set of maps. And so it's really up to the Democrats to get a message that's going to sell.
For Brooke and Ray, that was Andy Jackson, the elections policy analyst here at Civitas. Before you leave, if you have a chance this week, go to civitasclc.org and get your early bird tickets for the CLC conference that will be in 2020. We got some exciting speakers already lined up. You will want to be there. So any last thoughts, Brooke? Anything you want to shout out to our listeners?
I'm just going to echo what Ray said. We would love for you to join us at our Conservative Leadership Conference. It is our 15th anniversary. Going to be a lot of fun. We have, like Ray had mentioned, some exciting speakers. So actually stay tuned to that website, civitasclc.org, because that's where you're going to be kept up to date as to which speakers we have lined up. And hey, Ray and I would love to meet you in person and also
save money. Save yourself some money.
Yep. Get those early bird tickets before they sell out, because we have been told that there are only a few of them left. So limited number. Look forward to seeing you all. And thank you for listening and subscribing on iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify. Have a good week.